There would be a bloodbath if he is not elected in November. And finally, a political Ipsos new poll shows that half of the country in the United States of America believes Trump is a guilty man and should go to trial before the 2024 presidential election. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to defy U.S. President Joe Biden's warning not to launch a major military invasion in Rafah, which houses millions of Palestinian displaced civilians. But is Joe Biden even warning him for real, or is it just part of a useless charade for electoral purposes? Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert in fake news expose. What we heard last week on Western broadcast media was that U.S. President Joe Biden is deeply concerned about the prospect of Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordering a major ground operation in Gaza's southern city of Rafah. And we were supposed to take those concerns for real, just like we were supposed to believe that this was not staged. Fuad, was this something really that we were not supposed to hear coming out of Biden after his State of the Union address?
Definitely. I guess we're supposed to believe that this was a totally unplanned hot mic moment by U.S. President Joe Biden. And we're supposed to believe that Biden is suddenly extremely frustrated with the genocidal war that Netanyahu is waging. I'm not sure what he thinks he's trying to prove. I mean, it seems like he wants to have a heart-to-heart with Bibi about the genocide that's being waged with the weapons that he's sending from his own administration. The public isn't stupid, though, and they see this for what it really is, which is an attempt to garner political support, and it's electoral propaganda, essentially. His actions are nowhere near his words. In an interview with Jonathan Capehart on MSNBC, Biden was asked about this hot mic moment. Mm-hmm. He said, let's take a look.
You were caught on a hot mic after your State of the Union address talking to Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Senator Michael Bennett saying, quote, I told him, Bibi, and don't repeat this, but you and I are going to have a come to Jesus meeting. What do you mean by that?
What I meant was, it's an expression used in the southern part of my state, meaning a serious meeting. And it was, I've known Bibi for 50 years, and he knew what I meant by it.
So what's the come to Jesus part? What tough love are you going to give to the prime minister?
What's happening is he has a right to defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas. But he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world. It's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake.
As you can see, Marwa, Biden's plan is to sit Netanyahu down and have a strict talk with him about how the U.S.-sponsored genocide in Gaza is actually starting to counter Zionist interests and that he should be more careful to stop killing innocents.
Oh, my God.
This is not only an election charade, but it's also a naive take on the slaughter that's taking place in Gaza. And honestly, it's an insult to the over 35,000 Palestinians who have been killed and the over 60,000 who have been injured. So nothing will stop Netanyahu except the U.S. demanding a ceasefire at the mm-hmm. UNSC. Mm-hmm. Not just saying a ceasefire is a good idea, but mm-hmm. actually demanding one.
And they actually passed one on Monday afternoon, and it was without the U.S. even
exactly.
voting with a veto.
Abstention.
And yet the Israelis continued with the massacres.
Biden was even asked by MSNBC if he had any red lines for the Zionists who plan on invading Rafah, which is a desperately overcrowded city that's filled with displaced, over 1.2 million displaced Palestinian civilians. And his answer, Marwa, perfectly demonstrates why Benjamin Netanyahu will not listen to anything that the Biden administration has to say, mm-hmm. whether it's real or whether it's electoral propaganda. Mm-hmm. So let's take a look.
Let's hear that.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas.
So there is no red line for Israel, is there?
It doesn't seem so. It's outrageous that Western media is actually spouting this stuff. Biden repeats that he will never stop sending arms and funds to the Zionists. He says Rafah is a red line, and then 3 seconds later, he says there are no red lines. So what is it that's finally going to end this genocidal war? Because it's certainly not a come-to-Jesus meeting, or whatever it is that he said. Netanyahu watched the same interview that we all watched, and he saw it as a carte blanche to continue his genocide and to continue butchering Palestinians and decimating what's left of Rafah in the hopes that Egypt is going to take in all these displaced civilians. In an interview with Fox News, knowing that there's going to be zero accountability, Netanyahu refused to bow down to international pressure and vowed to move forward with the invasion of Rafah.
We're going to do it while we enable the civilian population in Rafah to leave, as we've done up to now, but we have to finish the job.
Netanyahu knows that Biden is using the Rafah invasion red line for electoral purposes, and he basically claps back at Biden and says that he has the support of the Israeli people in doing so. This is what happens when you say you'll never cut off weapons to Israel. Netanyahu is now openly defying Biden and the rest of the international community, not just with Rafah. So in an interview with Politico, he openly states, "We do not want a Palestinian state." And this comes right after his carte blanche from the U.S. president. Politico also reported recently, citing U.S. officials, that Washington has already accepted limited operations in Rafah, once again proving that there are no red lines and the Zionists can do what they
And audaciously say that they abstain from vetoing the so-called ceasefire, the temporary ceasefire in the UNSC. This is such a charade happening at the moment. Well, I completely understand where the people come from when they say they no longer trust Biden and they no longer want to vote for him because his words are not where his actions are.
At
the end of the day, thank you very much for letting us know what has been happening in the broadcast media, especially in the West End Zionist media concerning this very pressing issue. Thanks a million. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to digital mainstream media. So the result of U.S. President Joe Biden's weak foreign policy towards Zionist Israel has led to the Zionist Israeli Prime Minister to overtly show complete defiance when it comes to invading Rafah, stopping the genocide, or simply allowing food aid and medical supplies into the largest concentration camp on earth, known to the world as Gaza. So much so that mainstream media ran stories claiming that Biden is now considering conditioning military aid to Zionist Israel if they invade Rafah. With us is our digital mainstream media expert, Ms. Julia Qasim, to tell us how much of this is actually true.
Thanks, Marwa. So, well, let us begin by saying that none of that is true. So you see, the Biden administration is preparing to send more bombs and other weapons to Zionist Israel that would add to its military arsenal, even as Biden keeps publicly pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza. So this, Marwa, is according to the Wall Street Journal, which reported last week citing current and former U.S. officials. So the proposed arms delivery includes MK-82 bombs and KMU-572 joint direct action munitions that add precision guidance to bombs and FMU-139 bomb fuses at a value estimated to be in the tens of millions of dollars.
Oh, tens of millions of dollars, and still no condition on that.
No condition, no strings. So it's true that the congressional committee leaders would have to approve this transfer first. But, you know, as we remember in December 2023, the Biden administration skipped congressional review of Israeli weapon sales to Israel, not once, but twice. So what's going to stop them from doing it a third time?
Absolutely nothing.
So not Congress, essentially. It's enough that the Biden administration continues to unconditionally supply arms to Israel, as evidence piles up that the U.S.-made weapons have been used in strikes that have killed or injured Palestinian civilians. But now the Biden administration has the audacity to lie in the face of American taxpayers who are fully bearing the consequences and the financial burden of these free transfers to Israel by claiming that they will condition military aid going to Israel. So where do they think these weapons will end up? In a weapons depot somewhere underground? No. I mean, obviously they'll be used to expand the scope of the ongoing genocide in Gaza and Rafah. I mean, where else?
They will end up on the heads of innocent civilians, kids, women, elderly, just like they have been so for the past 6 months.
Right. And at the initial start, when the Zionist entity was declaring that they would invade Rafah, mm-hmm. The Biden administration had its empty words, but they immediately approved like arms transfers. And mind you, Marwa, the whole rhetoric is false, because mm-hmm. even back in November, Biden then said that conditioned aid to Israel was a worthy thought, as per this report by Politico, but he never actually followed up on it, of course. So in an article entitled "No Conditions on Future Israel Aid, Despite Biden's Worthwhile Thought Quip," written by Alexander Ward and Jonathan Lemire, mm-hmm. who said that days later after Biden's statement, senior U.S. officials hit the Sunday shows to rule out the proposal, hinting but not outright saying that there wouldn't be a shift in the administration's Israel policy. Mm-hmm. So Politico reported that one of Biden administration official suggested that Biden's aside, made in response to a reporter's question, was less about siding with progressive sentiment and more of a window into his private frustrations with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. So this reflects, of course, the U.S. administration's frustrations after 5 months of Israeli-U.S.-backed genocide and mm-hmm. having nothing to show for it militarily. But at the same time, it's practically the same old script that Biden recycles every 2 months to, quote-unquote, pressure Netanyahu into a ceasefire. But it would just be easier at the time for them to just hold off on their consistent vetoes mm-hmm. at the UN Security Council votes. And even yesterday, you know,
when they did hold off
on their vote, mm-hmm. nothing really changed on the situation on the ground.
Yeah.
The international body was not able to, you know, stop this genocide, as we could see from the scenes.
Zionists are not ready to comply.
Of course. So to add insult to that injury, Marwa, Netanyahu not only openly defied Biden's demand to stop the planned invasion of Rafah, because the U.S. knows that they're going to lose, he also lashed out at Senator Chuck Schumer, mm-hmm. Democratic Zionist Senate Majority Lead, calling Schumer's recent criticism of Netanyahu and call for early elections there totally inappropriate. Mm. So according to the New York Times, Netanyahu said in an interview with CNN that trying to replace the government of a sister democracy was not appropriate. "That's something that Israel, the Israeli public, does on its own," he said. "We're not a banana republic."
I find that hard to believe. Anyways, yes.
Yeah, so Netanyahu knows that he just takes tens of millions of dollars worth of U.S. taxpayer dollars for weapons, all for free from the U.S. With his other hand, he flips the bird with any American party, including the Biden administration officials, who criticize his basically failures in Gaza.
Yeah, I completely understand where that's going, and I completely am very interested and invested in how things will work out, given now that Netanyahu is now defying UNSC, the U.S., and every ally that ever stood beside him by not complying to that latest UN resolution for a temporary ceasefire. But anyways, thank you very much, Julia, for your contribution to this segment. Now, ladies and gents, we'll move on to social media expose. Comments made by former U.S. President Donald Trump during a rally in Dayton, Ohio, warning that there'd be a bloodbath for the country if he lost the upcoming elections, has taken the U.S. and social media, for that matter, by a storm. Let us remember what he said before we hear all about the hysteria from those words that were festered on social media by our social media expert, Sima Itayim. Let's hear what he said.
"If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath."
Sima, he said it's going to be a bloodbath, and those words sparked widespread condemnation, given that recently, when he lost the elections, there was violence that ensued in the streets of the U.S. So how did social media react to this?
Hi, Marwa. Thanks for having me. So if we know Trump well, which we do, we already know that he cried fake news after the widespread condemnation he received as backlash.
Definitely.
To these comments. And he claimed it was taken out of context.
Yeah.
So in a tweet on Truth Social, since Trump's not on Twitter again yet, he wrote, "The fake news media and their Democrat partners in the destruction of our nation pretended to be shocked at my use of the word bloodbath, even though they fully understood that I was simply referring to imports allowed by crooked Joe Biden," which are killing the automobile industry. "The United Auto Workers, but not their leadership, fully understand what I mean. With the electric car mandate being pushed by Biden, there soon won't be any cars made in the USA, unless I'm elected president, in which case auto manufacturing will thrive like never before. MAGA 2024.
All caps lock. All uppercase.
Hysterical. So if you zoom out and you listen to the clip, you see that he really was talking about the automobile industry.
Yeah.
It was a broader discussion within that context, but it's not as cut and dry as he wants us to believe. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what he was trying to say. But it didn't go down well at all with the Democrats and the Liberals.
I can see that.
For instance, Robert Reich Berkley, mm-hmm. professor and former U.S. Secretary of Labor, went as far as calling Trump fascist.
Oh, my God.
We've heard that many times before. Yeah. He tweeted the following. This week, Trump has warned of a bloodbath if he's not elected. Promised again to release violent Jan 6 criminals, claimed immigrants aren't people, and called for the prosecution of Liz Cheney. These are warning signs of fascism. If we ignore them, here's what happens next.
What happens next?
Reich posted a 5-minute video explaining his views about this specific incident.
I want to talk to you about the F word. No, no, not that F word. I'm talking about fascism. Is Donald Trump really a fascist, as some would say? Or is the word authoritarian sufficient? The term fascism is often used loosely, but you can generally identify fascists by their hate of the other, vengeful nationalism, and repression of dissent.
So he proceeds to list 5 steps in which Trump can turn America into a fascist state.
Ooh.
And this shows the alarming level of fracture amongst U.S. politicians when it comes to the upcoming presidential elections. But it's never really based in anything grounded. Like, he cited the Jan 6 Capitol Hill storming. Like, that was...
It's a circus. Oh, my God,
we know it was staged. There was footage of them letting them in. Yeah. And that's still, like, his main thing, you know? Like, that's... Anyway. So moving on to Occupy Democrats, who sounded the alarm after both Trump's bloodbath comment and the promotional video he published right after.
Mm-hmm.
They tweeted a screenshot from the video with an extreme close-up of Trump's eyes in black and white. Not a pretty sight, I know, but let's see what they tweeted. Breaking. Fascism experts sound the alarm after Donald Trump releases a jaw-dropping video in which he ominously threatens Democrats directly and promises to do horrible things to us.
Ooh.
With his criminal problems mounting, Trump is ripping a vile new approach straight from the fascist playbook. The indicted ex-president released a disturbing video of an extreme close-up of his eyes in black and white that visually evokes 1984 and other dystopian works of fiction.
God, Sima, that's so American.
What he said was even worse. If you around with us, if you do something bad to us, we're going to do things to you that have never been done before, Trump says in the video. The video doesn't expand on exactly what the things are that Trump and MAGA want to do to us, but given the long and violent history of fascism, one can imagine just how horrible they might be. Trump has already incited one violent insurrection.
Oh my God.
If he wins the White House again, he will seek retribution against all who opposed his previous coup attempt. This man belongs in prison. Lives are at stake. Democrats are using this as leverage against Trump, just grasping at straws, whatever
it's
they can.
It's overdramatic, though.
Yeah, for the upcoming elections. But we have to acknowledge that, you know, what Trump really meant was, if I don't win this election, it won't just be a bloodbath for the auto industry, but it'll be a bloodbath for the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. People must maybe took it a bit out of. But either way, I mean, it seems the U.S. is, you know, headed for, like, some interesting times. To say the least.
We're watching, we have the popcorn ready, and we're seeing how this will unfold, especially in the upcoming few months. Thank you very much, Sima.
I really
enjoyed this segment with you, because America and its social media is just on another planet, especially when it has to do with Trump. So thank you. For showing us this was amazing, ladies and gents, but we have more for you on Figures Exposé. In the aftermath of the Trump bloodbath comment, a political magazine Ipsos poll found that most Americans think Trump should go to trial before the 2024 presidential election. 3 in 5 Americans say they think the federal trial on Donald Trump's 2020 election subversion case should take place before the presidential election in November, levels that held steady since August 2023. Now, the poll also finds that a plurality of Americans believes that Trump if convicted, should face imprisonment over just probation, a financial penalty, or no penalty whatsoever. When asked if they believe Trump is guilty of the alleged crimes, Americans were split by partisanship. Roughly half of the respondents believe Trump is guilty of the alleged crimes in the sensitive documents case with 52%, falsifying business records case with 50%, federal 2020 election subversion case with 49%, and Georgia election subversion case with 49%. Now, believe that Trump is guilty is split by party. While a majority of Democrats say they believe Trump is guilty in all four cases with 86%, 86%, 87%, and 86% respectively. Now, fewer Republicans think the same with 16%, 14%, 12%, and 12% respectively. And a majority of independents believe Trump is guilty in the four cases with 58%, 54%, 54%, and 53%. Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. So we heard during our episode today, voices outraged at Trump's bloodbath comment condemning the presidential candidate as a fascist and a future dictator if elected. But to be fair, there were also a lot of voices who found that this is just the way Donald Trump speaks and that he genuinely meant no harm in the context he was using the term. For one, look what Carl Emmerich had to say about this on TikTok.
Did Donald Trump just threaten violence if he loses in November at a recent rally? Well, let's play the tape in question.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Now, I find it really funny that a lot of Republicans are saying you need to look at the full context of this clip to see he's talking about the auto industry. And the reason I find that funny is immediately before the bloodbath remarks, Trump calls for a 100% tariff on cars imported from Mexico, which is a horrible policy. Putting that aside, even without the additional context, Trump is obviously not calling for violence in that clip. Anyone that is using even a sliver of good faith interpretation can see he's clearly using figurative language. The reason I find this frustrating is Donald Trump says wild stuff all the time. For example, he recently called the January 6th prisoners hostages that he would very, very seriously consider pardoning. Talk about that, or the hundreds of other crazy things he says. There is no reason to hone in on nothing burgers like these bloodbath statements.
And we end off with Jim Walsh on TikTok, who said it really doesn't matter if Trump was literal or rhetorical in his threats. What scares Jim, apparently, is something else completely. Let us find out what it is.
So our friend Donald, the Mango Mussolini, has promised, quote, a bloodbath, unquote, if he doesn't get back in this November. And of course, the question is, does he mean literally? Is he inciting violence? Or is he just pandering to the brain-dead faithful? To me, the answer is, it doesn't matter. We just don't want this guy back in office. We gotta do what we gotta do to make sure he doesn't get back in. That's the worst possible scenario. He said something, though, in the speech that concerned me a lot more. When he said that he was going to go crazy with the tariffs on foreign cars. Tariffs suck. They serve a very limited special interest, but they're awful. They set the stage for depressions and wars, and have many times in our history. That's what scares me.
And with this frenzy, ladies and gents, we end off our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A coalition of 34 Harvard University student organizations has condemned the Israeli regime's bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Boston Herald has covered this story and tells us more. The Harvard Law School student government has passed a resolution calling on the university to fully divest from any institution that supports the ongoing Israeli genocide of Palestinians in war-torn Gaza. The resolution pushes the Harvard Management Company, HMC, which oversees the university's $50 billion endowment, to divest completely from weapons manufacturers, firms, academic programs, corporations, and all other institutions that aid the ongoing occupation of Palestine and the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. In the resolution, the Harvard Law School student government points to Harvard's investment of nearly $200 million in companies tied to the Israeli military and illegal Israeli settlements in Palestine, as well as the Harvard Management Company's previous divestment from South African apartheid regime in 1986 and the tobacco industry in 1990. The resolution's author, Harvard Law School student Swap Agrawal, who also serves as co-president of the law school student government, said members of the body have heard from students who felt strongly that this call was necessary to put pressure on things to change. Agrawal said in a statement on Friday night, 29th of March, Palestinian students at Harvard Law School have lost dozens of family members in the ongoing genocide. Students are deeply troubled that money held in trust for their benefit is being used to support that genocide. Agrawal revealed the resolution was influenced by the International Court of Justice's statement in January, which found it plausible that Israel has engaged in actions that breached the Genocide Convention. Two board members stepped down following the resolution vote, where 12 members supported, 4 opposed and 3 abstained. Regina Denigris and Cameron Atkins wrote in their resignation letter that they stepped down because they strongly disagreed with the resolution being considered by the student government. They claimed that an anonymity motion passed at a 26th of March meeting was in violation of a provision of the student government constitution stating that all votes of the student council should be held in open session and minutes shall be made public. In a statement on Friday, 29th of March, Harvard University spokesperson Jason Newton made it clear it opposes calls for a policy of boycotting Israel and its academic institutions, citing former university president Lawrence Bako's response to the Crimson Editorial Board's 2022 endorsement of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. Earlier this year, Claudine Gay, former president of Harvard, stepped down after pro-Palestinian demonstrations on campus amid Israel's ongoing war in Gaza and also accusations of plagiarism. During a testimony, Claudine Gay faced criticism for not addressing the issue of the so-called genocide of Jews as a violation of Harvard's code of conduct. Some members of Congress also accused Gay of not doing enough to condemn and combat anti-Semitism on Harvard's campus. Affairs Al Jazeera television network has also covered this story and tells us more. A coalition of 34 Harvard University student organizations has condemned the Israeli regime's bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. In a statement published recently, the students said they hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence in Gaza. The statement added, "The apartheid regime is the only one to blame." The organizations signing the letter, including Muslim and Palestinian support groups as well as others named for a variety of backgrounds, including the Harvard Jews for Liberation and the African American Resistance Organization. Harvard University has produced 8 former presidents and 4 of the 9 current Supreme Court justices. However, Harvard University alumni criticized the pro-Palestinian statement and urged the university to take action against the signatories. Lawrence Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton and former university president, was one of several Harvard graduates to criticize the current Harvard leadership for failing to declare clear support for Israel. Recently, New York City Mayor Eric Adams drew fire for promoting violence and Islamophobia over his remarks referring to pro-Palestine protesters as extremists. Hundreds of people marched in Manhattan to express their support for Palestine. The Israeli regime has started its war machine against the Palestinians in the wake of a surprise major operation by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas against the occupiers. The multi-pronged operation was launched from Gaza in response to months of violence against the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the continued presence of Israeli extremists in the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Independent observers believe that Washington and its Western allies have been active partners in the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes and atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza. The website Axios has also covered the same story. The chief executive officers running a whole host of American business giants have urged the blacklisting of the Harvard University students who recently signed a statement calling out Israel for the developments that have been unfolding across the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip over the past several months. The chief executive officers, who run a whole host of American business giants, demanded the witch hunt 2 days after the issuance of the statement by a coalition of 34 Harvard University organizations. The students said they hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence in Gaza. Calling up an unprecedented 300,000 reservists, the Israeli regime has declared a long war on Gaza in response to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. Gaza's resistance movement initiated the operation in response to the occupying regime's decades-long campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Palestinians in Gaza. The Israeli war has so far massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians, including women and children. The military campaign has seen the regime leveling entire districts of Gaza and featured its use of banned white phosphorus munitions against the densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The Harvard University student statement said, "The apartheid regime is the only one to blame for the developments in Gaza." Moving ahead of the others, billionaire hedge fund chief executive officer Bill Ackman demanded that Harvard University release the names of the students. Bill Ackman said in a post on X, "If the members support the letter, the names of the signatories should be made public so their views are publicly known."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, Why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, since we are in the month of Ramadan, the blessed month, which is in fact granting us a lot of blessings, inshallah, by God, let me actually start our episode with this question, Sheikh, with i'tikaf, because some people might actually like to do i'tikaf, you know, in every month, especially in this special month. Would you talk a little bit about this issue and this concept, and is there any recommendation for this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the concept of i'tikaf is something very few people know about. There are many people who do not have a proper understanding of the rules and conditions of i'tikaf and how it should be observed. So I would like to shed light on some aspects of i'tikaf. Probably there will be some more details. First of all, i'tikaf should be observed in the central mosque of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the central mosque is the mosque which is lit in Arabic terminology called Masjid Jami.
Okay? Right.
So every city or township has a central mosque where people in large numbers usually turn up. They pray and they offer, they perform their rituals in that mosque. So when it comes to the local mosque, of course, it's not valid to perform i'tikaf in the mosque, which is in your image, in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. For example, everyone has mosques in their neighborhood, so you cannot observe i'tikaf there unless it is considered to be a very important and, for example, a central mosque. There could be many central mosques in a city, for example, depending on how, depending on the number of people coming to that mosque. So this is one point. Many people ask, because of a lack of knowledge, people ask whether they are allowed to observe i'tikaf in their own homes.
Right.
Of course, it's not permissible.
Right.
I'tikaf is a recommended act. Of course, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, observed i'tikaf during the last 10 days of Ramadan, and of course during the month of Rajab. And it's rewarding, and there is tremendous reward in observing i'tikaf. The thing is that once you start observing i'tikaf, then in the beginning it is mustahab, but when it is the third day you are going to start, then i'tikaf becomes obligatory. Mm-hmm. You cannot skip it. You cannot avoid it.
Should it be actually in 3 days or more than?
Of course, it depends. Of course, it can be observed for 10 days of the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the minimum period of i'tikaf is 3 days.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And the third day is obligatory.
Yeah, it becomes obligatory. And when you observe i'tikaf, it is necessary also to observe fast.
Right.
To observe fast. And there are some strict conditions. For example, exclude yourself inside the mosque, then you are not going to leave the mosque. You are not going to get out of the mosque premises.
Right.
In some few cases, of course, there are you are allowed to leave.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you give me hope, deliver this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawidar, guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of God, the blessed month of Ramadan, with Sheikh Chawid. Sheikh Chawid, you were talking about itikaf, and before the break, you mentioned that there are a few cases that makes it possible for the person who's observing itikaf actually to leave the mosque, the central mosque, right?
Yes.
Would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. For example, it's very when it's very urgent,
mm-hmm.
you have a kid at home, and he is he needs to be taken to a doctor,
right?
Or for example, you want to tend to someone who is in bed, or very quickly, and then come back. Maybe even I read in a book that even if you want to bid farewell to someone mm-hmm. who is a close relative, like your parents want to, for example,
leave town,
go on a Hajj pilgrimage, mm-hmm. and you want to take them to drop them at the airport. Some exceptions. These are some of the exceptions. But and if it's not very urgent,
uh-huh.
it's the urgency of something is judged by the common view, the custom. If it's not deemed necessary, mm. it's not permissible to step out of the mosque area. And then, of course, there are some important things. Like, for example, if you want to go to the washroom, mm. or maybe perform the ritual bathing.
Yes,
these are things you are allowed.
Mm-hmm. So, if the urgency has been met, I mean, after the
yes.
urgency, after you have left the mosque area, and then you got your job done, and then you're back to the mosque area
yes.
again.
Yes.
So, should you actually continue your itikaf whatever days you have passed, or no, you have to start it all over again?
No, itikaf means you started on a specific day and finish it on a specific day. For example, during the month of Rajab, there are 3 days which coincide with the birthday of the commander of faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. So you cannot do it on the 20th of Rajab mm-hmm. or on the 25th. So you have to, also, of course, if you want to observe itikaf on any occasion, if you want to do so, there's no objection, there's no problem. Okay, if you want to fix a few days for observing itikaf, for example, if you make a vow that you will observe itikaf from the 10th of Ramadan until the 13th of Ramadan, it's a vow, okay? It's something else. You can observe it and there would be no problem.
Mm-hmm. And, during the month of Ramadan, so everybody's fasting if they are able to, if there aren't any, conditions which make it difficult for the person who's doing the itikaf actually to fast. Well, we know that. But
yes.
What about the other months?
Of
when
course,
they are observing yeah. itikaf, should they be fasting?
Yeah,
too?
They should be fasting.
Uh-huh.
Fasting is necessary.
But from the third day onward?
No.
All the 3 days. Uh-huh, all the
fasting
3 days.
Begins from the first day. Okay,
uh-huh,
you should observe fasting from the very first day, from the
I
very
see.
Onset.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Shavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan with Sheikh Shavid. What are the things which are recommended or even obligatory for a person whose intention is actually to observe i'tikaf? So what are those things that they should do?
Okay. When you isolate yourself in the central mosque, it is what is necessary is to sit in the mosque and sit in a mosque. And of course, even if you do not do anything, i'tikaf means that you isolate yourself from the worldly glamours, from worldly attractions, and you just sit inside the mosque and you break off with everything else. So, but this is the wajib part. This is what necessary. You sit in the mosque and that is it. But when it comes to certain a'mal, certain practices, of course, the a'mal are too many. For example, you can recite the Holy Quran, which is very good to recite. And of course, there is tremendous reward in reciting the Holy Quran. And there are special du'as, supplications, which are mentioned in the book of Islam, in the book of Mafatih al-Jannah. Okay? The book of Mafatih al-Jannah, I would like to tell to our audience that it is replete with important supplications, very useful supplications, which can be read and recited on different occasions. If, for example, an individual is in search of a dua or a special supplication, they can find it in the in Mafatih al-Jannah, which is a book that was composed by Sheikh Abbas Qummi. So it is a very important book, and of course there are special supplications which can be recited during i'tikaf. Now, if a person does not engage in dua, for example, supplication, that's all. That's okay. No problem. He is not there is no objection to him, because it's not necessary to engage in praying, worshiping, and of course reciting dua from morning till night. And because it's, you will get tired, so you can, for example, drink tea, you can eat your meal, and then also you can engage in a discussion with your friend. For example, if you are not alone in the central mosque, there are maybe hundreds of other people. So if you want to engage in a debate, for example, about a certain issue, like if you have your book, the Holy Quran or any other book, you want to discuss it with your friend, that's okay. For example, you can give 1 hour of your time discussing a book on Islamic jurisprudence, a book on Islamic, for example, beliefs and theology and many, many.
Could they discuss something else, like outside of the religious, for example, topics?
That's discouraged, because what you are supposed to do is detach yourself from. Of course, sometimes you might happen talking about politics. But of course, politics is not something, it's not taboo, it's not forbidden. You can talk about the developments taking place in the region. That's all right.
What about the studies, like scientific studies? A student, in fact, wants to study also as well as doing i'tikaf.
So, yeah, of course, you can take your laptop into the mosque and start doing, for example, your studies for a few minutes or a few hours, and then start engaging yourself in dua and supplications.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, actually, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. And in this particular episode, we talked about the i'tikaf too. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here, Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
Flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Israel presses ahead with its relentless airstrikes and shelling of the besieged Gaza Strip as the death toll from the genocidal war surpasses 33,000.